From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. More than 67,000 Americans are dangerously ill today in the hospital with COVID-19. That's a new high for hospitalizations and nearly twice as many as 2 weeks ago. We're going to touch down now in two hot spots around the country, starting with Iowa. Natalie Krebs is health reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Natalie, Iowa is not alone in its struggle with COVID. What does the situation look like in your state?
Yeah, so we're seeing a rapid increase in cases. We're seeing upwards of 4,000 cases a day, nearly 20,000 in the last week, which is huge for a state that just has a population of about 3 million. Hospitalizations have nearly doubled this month. We have health officials warning us across the country, basically, that our system is kind of on the brink of being overwhelmed.
You know, it's interesting. Iowa doesn't have a statewide mask order, but your Republican Governor Kim Reynolds this week did make some new rules. She said that gatherings of more than 25 people indoors aren't allowed, more than 100 people outdoors not allowed unless everyone is wearing a mask. But I know there's some concern that this is largely toothless, that this is not going to make much of a difference. What are you hearing?
Yeah, you're right. We have no statewide mask mandate, and Governor Reynolds issued orders earlier this week basically targeted at large crowds. But yeah, I mean, I'm hearing from public health experts that this is being spread with informal social gatherings, you know, informal family gatherings. And so basically her new regulations really didn't target that. And a lot of people are afraid it's just really not going to target the spread of the virus across Iowa.
Schools have been asking the state for permission to shut down again and go back to online learning. What can you tell us about that situation?
Yeah, we've had a number of school districts ask for permission to, from a waiver from the Department of Education, to go online again. Our state has rules in place where the county percent positivity rate over a 14-day average has to be above 15% in order for schools to ask this permission. Over 75% of Iowa's counties are pretty much at this level right now, even more than that. And so we've had a number of school districts are asking the state permission now to go online.
So you're painting a pretty bleak picture here, but do you get the sense that everyday people, everyday Iowans, see what's happening around them? Are they taking this latest surge seriously?
Yeah, that's a big debate here. I mean, we have the governor, we have public health officials are really encouraging people to follow public health mitigation strategies. It's hard to get people to wear masks down here. Local public health administrators have told me the same thing, that they're just struggling to get people to follow social distancing, masking, you know.
Why do you think that is?
Suggestions. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, some people point to the fact that Governor Reynolds hasn't issued a universal mask mandate. Some people are pointing to what they say are mixed messages about what people should be doing. You know, they're confused. They have kind of taken a position in this pandemic. It's really unclear exactly what is going on, why people aren't always following mitigation strategies.
Natalie Krebs, health reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Let's get the view now from Tennessee with Blake Farmer, a senior healthcare reporter for Nashville Public Radio. Blake, what's the state of the pandemic there?
Well, you know, the numbers are higher than ever, and that's cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. A few hospitals are starting to divert patients to other facilities, but really the big alarm's not about having enough beds. It's really about staffing. The state of Tennessee has stepped in to help some hospitals pay to bring in contract nurses and doctors from out of town, but, you know, they're getting harder to find.
And we understand that lately it's been mainly rural areas of Tennessee that have driven the growth of new cases of the coronavirus. What is causing the spread there?
You know, the rise in cases really is everywhere, but there has been this big shift from urban areas like Nashville and Memphis to really the most rural reaches of the region. These are places that have really seen almost no cases until the last month or two, and now they're getting dozens a day, and these are small communities. And these are places that have also, like, lost their hospital in recent years, some of them, which creates this kind of cascading effect. You know, I talked to a leader of Fentress County, which is this scenic community you might consider in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. A hospital closed recently. He told me, you know, he's really just hoping this spike blows over because he doesn't feel there's much he can do to slow the spread of the virus. In fact, he really feels like the state of Tennessee's kind of passed the buck by not doing more to restrict people on the state level.
So we know that Tennessee's Governor, Republican Bill Lee, has resisted calls for a statewide mask mandate so far. I wonder if he has changed his mind about that. And as you said, there's frustration from some rural areas. Are local officials and public health experts putting any pressure on him?
Well, you know, we've asked the governor a dozen different ways what it would take for him to mandate masks finally. And he's really just convinced that there is a better chance of getting people to follow a masking order if it's made at the local level. Public health experts are continuing to ask for the governor to reconsider. Vanderbilt University here in Nashville keeps putting out studies showing links between masks and outbreaks. This week, they showed that in Tennessee, death rates from COVID are twice as high in places where masks are not mandated.
Mm. And is the response to that closing schools or putting new restrictions on businesses?
Well, statewide, there's really not much debate about reinstating new business restrictions. The largest cities, Nashville and Memphis, have slowed the reopening of in-person schools to some degree. But for the most part, school districts are just managing day-to-day, closing high schools for a week here or there to manage all the teachers who are out having to quarantine, students too. But there's just not much talk about flattening the curve anymore. The plan seems to be for now, find a way to live with the virus and just hope a vaccine comes sooner than later.
When you walk down the street, depending on where you are, I guess, are most people wearing a mask?
No, I wouldn't say most people. At least if you're outside of the largest urban areas, the mask is something that is still not on every face for sure.
Blake Farmer, senior healthcare reporter for Nashville Public Radio. Thank you, Blake.
You're welcome.
Health officials are urging people to get the flu shot to prevent an influx of flu cases that need medical attention when the system's already overwhelmed by the coronavirus pandemic. Connecticut Public Radio's Nicole Leonard spoke with health experts and residents about how they're approaching the flu differently this year.
A group of people in red and yellow reflective vests huddled together on the town green in Woolkit, Connecticut at 9 in the morning. Some of them work for the Chesprocott Health District. Others are volunteers with the town's Medical Reserve Corps.
And I have two people to assist moving this tent.
They're setting up a drive-through flu shot clinic where people can get an influenza vaccine without leaving their cars that start lining up as early as 20 minutes before the clinic opens.
Which arm you want in it? All right. Don't forget to put your car in park.
Maura Esposito is Chesprocott's health director.
We did one last year, and it was a success, but looking at the cars right now, we are booming. We know it's safer for everyone. We don't want to put anybody more at risk than they are right now in the pandemic.
The health district has converted all of its flu clinics to outdoor drive-thrus this year to increase safety precautions for COVID-19. And many towns, cities, and health departments across the country are doing the same. Public health leaders say it's critical for people to get a flu vaccine this year so that they minimize their risk of becoming seriously ill from at least one infectious virus. There's still no vaccine yet for the novel coronavirus, and scientists say it's possible to contract both COVID-19 and the flu at the same time. Kate Glendon is a public health specialist at Chesprocott.
We started our flu clinics all in October this year within the first 2 to 3 weeks. To make sure that we can vaccinate as much people as possible, as early as possible.
The annual flu season typically runs from October through the spring. Last season, more than 400,000 people nationally were hospitalized, and 22,000 died, including children. There are a lot of different strains of influenza. Scientists try to create vaccines that will best match the strains that they think will show up each season. That means the flu vaccine reduces illness by an average of 40 to 60% each year. Dr. Kevin Dekaus says it may not be perfect, but the protective benefits are worth it.
Even if you receive the vaccine and you manage to come down with flu anyway, the likelihood is that the case of flu that you have is going to be much milder.
Dekaus is chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at UConn Health, the University of Connecticut's teaching center. He and his colleagues have been particularly busy managing COVID-19 cases. Dekaus says if more people get a flu vaccine, then it may help reduce the overall number of people who need diagnostic tests, sick appointments, and hospitalization.
And the elephant in the room is COVID. And we really want to minimize the influenza as much as possible because we have this other issue that is so big and so very important from a public health standpoint.
Symptoms for the flu and COVID-19 largely overlap, so diagnosing people will be challenging. Dekau says this is where access to quick and frequent testing for both viruses will be crucial. And he also hopes that continued social distancing, hand washing, and other pandemic precautions will help limit the spread of the flu. At the Wolcott drive-thru clinic, residents Dawn and Jeff Olson were taking all the precautions they could get.
I never had the flu shot before, ever. Never had the flu, and I'm just nervous with the COVID this year.
Same for me. With COVID, I get the flu shot every year, but extra reason for this year.
Health providers in Connecticut and across the country are reporting higher than normal turnout this year at many flu shot locations. For Here and Now, I'm Nicole Leonard in Hartford, Connecticut.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Intense flooding driven by the remnants of Tropical Storm Eta has overwhelmed parts of North Carolina, killing at least 7 people across the state. Some videos of the damage are leaving people breathless. Amber Roberts, a reporter with Fox 46, was reporting live yesterday from Alexander County, standing on a bridge with water rushing underneath when the bridge split in two.
This is incredibly scary! Okay, we're backing up. Just right here.
Wow, thankfully Roberts and her crew got off the bridge safely. This storm is how we're going to start our weekly social media roundup today. Femi Ok is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Yeah, oh my God, no kidding, Femi. What else are you seeing online about this storm's destruction?
You did a beautiful job of describing what happened to Amber Fox 46, as she's known on Twitter. That is where you will find the video. Rex Chapman, who everyone should follow on Twitter because he finds the best video, says, give this reporter a pay rise. What I am seeing online is what I see often with tropical weather, because it is so extreme that sometimes you see some fake videos out there. So watch out. So if you see a shark floating through a neighborhood, that shark has been floating through neighborhoods for every tropical storm and hurricane since we've been able to have our little phone videos out there. So watch out for that. Triple check before you share. I know you won't, but I'm going to say it anyway. Something that tickled me that I did triple check was a giant American alligator captured strolling through a golf course in Florida as the tropical storm rain came down. The descriptions of this alligator, Godzilla, lives in Naples, and that's as big as a dinosaur. Also, Tropical Storm Eta brought out a lot of citizen reporters as well. Chelsea Rosa reports a man kayaking through a suburban neighborhood. We've seen those shots many times. It looks like a lake. And Chelsea posts kayaking through the streets of Florida, crying emoji. But this is not ironic crying. This is desperate crying. And then a comment. And this really kind of puts us, where are we right now with our weather that we're seeing? If you remember, the end of tropical or the hurricane season is November the 30th. So we're very, very close to that. Easter Bunny Terror posts, climate change, sea level rise. Now we can go boating right where we live. So connecting what we're seeing with Eta with climate change.
Femi, what a season it's been. We're now looking at the 29th storm, Theta, which is spinning towards
Europe.
Yeah, very active. Yeah, you know, another big story on the social media front this week, of course, was TikTok. And we've been reporting on the Trump administration's order to ban the Chinese-owned app in the U.S. unless it was sold to an American company. That deadline came and went yesterday. TikTok is still standing. What are social media users saying?
And TikTokers are still posting. TikTok US promised its US users, "We're not going anywhere," even after President Trump said, "As far as TikTok is concerned, we're banning them from the United States." So TikTok currently challenging the ban, still in negotiations with the government, asking for more time to finalize a US partner. And on social, TikTokers are saying, for instance, Ryan is saying, "Everyone is worried about the election. I just wondered what happened to the TikTok ban. It seemed to have gone away." Lady Liberty making fun of the Trump administration. What happened to all that winning? Lots of celebrations from the TikTok community. Lots of people had forgotten that TikTok had been banned because nothing seemed to have happened. But behind the scenes, just digging a little bit deeper, MLCOM28 posts on Twitter, "TikTok isn't the important part. What is important is the laziness of Congress that's given the presidency too much power to wield enormous power all by himself. What's happening to TikTok should terrify everyone." So going for the big picture there, not for the small one about the actual app.
Femi, we got to get to this story out of London. There's a debate online about a new statue that was dedicated in the city to the memory of Mary Wollstonecraft. This is the 18th century feminist and author. But there are some people who are very, very upset about this statue.
We are wading into a debate about feminism and art, and it's super feisty. So Mary Wollstonecraft is known as the mother of feminism. She's also the actual mother of Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein, but that's by the by. There is a sculpture that is dedicated, honouring her, and it was created by Maggie Hambling. Let me describe it for you. It is a silver base, a swirling silver base, and from that silver base emerges a naked woman. From the lovers of this sculpture is historian Dr. Fern Riddle, who posts, "I love this. It reminds me of Metropolis crossed with the birth of Venus." That's the loving the sculpture camp. From the hating the sculpture camp, we have J.R. Tomlin, who says, "All that fundraising and work for a silver Barbie doll on top of a phallus shape." So the back and forth is, should the mother of feminism be seen with no clothes on? Does it matter? And so feminists on both sides of this argument are coming out and having amazing debates. I really recommend you one, see the sculpture, and also follow the debates, because it's a really feisty one.
It is fascinating. Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
It's been almost 2 weeks since most of the country set clocks back an hour as daylight saving time came to an end. So we've had time to adjust to that extra hour and earlier sunsets. For many people, there's a lot more to adjust to than that. The darker days can bring on a stretch of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. 27-year-old Gabrielle Starr says it comes on gradually.
As the days get shorter and it gets darker earlier, I just feel my energy levels dropping.
Starr was diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder when she was a sophomore in college. This year, the coronavirus pandemic is making things even more difficult. She's living on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and feels she's already been hibernating for months.
It just feels like it's hitting me harder than it usually does. I mean, yesterday I was in bed till noon just because it was cloudy and gray, and I just, you know, I didn't have any motivation to get up.
And this is different from somebody just kind of turning over and saying, I really don't want to get up today. This bed feels so good. There's another layer there. How do you describe it?
Maybe like wading through molasses. It's feeling like things are insurmountable, like even things that normally would be so easy.
Andy Woodnut of Lexington, Massachusetts, says he knew months ago that he needed to bolster his defenses against seasonal affective disorder.
I started to speak with my psychiatrist and my therapist probably as early as June, July time, to start to figure out what we needed to do, either in terms of medications or in terms of therapies and just planning in general, so that I was in a much, much better shape to be able to deal with it.
Woodnut is the IT director for a software company. He was diagnosed with major depressive disorder 4 years ago after his family went through a difficult time. Last year, he was hit with seasonal affective disorder. He had suicidal thoughts and gained weight after he turned to food to cope. He doesn't want another winter like that.
The pandemic has really kind of amplified that thought and my concern of being, you know, isolated because I'm working from home, not being able to go out as often as I might like, or not seeing the sunshine as much as I would like.
Now, Woodnut maps out his days to make sure he finishes work by a specific hour and spends time with his family. He says his wife has become attuned to when his moods start to destabilize. Woodnut's therapist has told him his recovery is like a three-legged stool. To stay upright, he needs medicine, therapy, and exercise.
I don't cancel therapy regardless of what I'm doing. I always make time. I've lost the weight that I gained last winter, and I'd lost a load before that. And so that, along with a plan and doing some simple things like mindfulness, using light therapy for the winter and taking vitamin D, those are all things that help prepare me and help me manage what happens through the winter.
Gabrielle Starr says with SAD, she struggles to get through her work days as a sports podcaster. She knows pretty soon she's not going to want to leave the house.
One of the things that I usually do to just help my overall mental health, especially in the winter, is I force myself to book workout classes that are non-refundable because, you know, I don't want to get off the couch, but I also don't want to lose, you know, a $25 yoga class or SoulCycle class. But those options are not available this winter.
Kristen McGregor is a clinical health psychologist with University of Massachusetts Memorial Healthcare. She predicts this winter will be extra difficult for most people with SAD.
We in the mental health field are in a bit of a panic, I think. My job is hard in the wintertime anyway, because people, not only are we sort of blue because it's dark and it's cold and we're not able to do some of the things that we enjoy doing, but it's hard to be motivated to take care of ourselves and eat well and things like that. And so I think we're just all preparing for people to not be able to see their loved ones at the holidays or not be able to travel and do the things that they would normally do. Even just, you know, physical activity, people would go walk around the mall or go walk around Home Depot. And a lot of people don't feel safe doing that right now. And so I think we're really going to need to get creative.
And getting creative means what? What are you recommending for your clients?
I think trying to maximize what you do in the day, even going out and running an errand at lunchtime or before you go to work, just to be able to be outside in the daylight. And if that's not possible, if you can maybe fit your office or where you do your work near a window so you are near sunlight. And they sell those light boxes that sort of mimic the sun. It's less ideal than actually getting outside in the sunshine, but you can sit in front of one of those in the morning for a couple hours just to sort of stimulate that notion of being out in the sun to see if that helps a little bit.
That's Kristen McGregor, a clinical health psychologist with University of Massachusetts Memorial Healthcare. She says a small number of her patients are actually doing better this year. The pandemic has made them feel less alone in their isolation. If you'd like to speak to someone from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the phone number is 1-800-950-NAMI or NAMI.
Amnesty International says it's likely that hundreds of civilians were killed in a massacre earlier this week in northern Ethiopia. Fighting between government troops and forces loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front broke out last week and now appears to be escalating. The BBC's Kalkadan Yebitol joins us on Skype from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. And Kalkadan, there is a longstanding tension between the government and the TPLF. Tell us why.
For close to three decades, the TPLF used to be a dominant political force in Ethiopia, but that came to an end when the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018. After that, they felt that they are sidelined by the current Prime Minister, and when he restructured and rebranded the ruling party, and he called it a prosperity party. The TPLF left that party and remained a ruling party in the northernmost part of the country, Tigray. After that, there have been long-standing tensions between the two, and there was an escalation in September when the Tigray region or the Tigray state held an election, a regional election, despite a nationwide ban due to the COVID-19 pandemic. They said that the prime minister is using the pandemic as a pretext to stay in power. And then he and his administration accused them of conducting the election illegally. Last week, they manifested themselves in the form of military confrontations. And we have heard dozens of hundreds of people. And now this report indicates that hundreds of civilians might have been massacred.
Right. Please tell us more about that. What do we know about the massacre and who's responsible for it?
Since the fighting broke out last week, the area has been in an information blackout. There is no internet and telephone lines are not working. So that means we don't have the clear picture of it. But Amnesty International's report details that civilians in a place called Maykadra were killed. Amnesty didn't confirm who the responsible were for the killing, who the perpetrators were. But they say that eyewitnesses indicate that retreating soldiers loyal to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front or the TPLF were the ones who carried out these killings. They, of course, denied these claims, and they, in fact, accused the federal government of killing civilians by airstrikes. But what we know is many people were killed, and eyewitnesses are saying that forces loyal to the TPLF were perpetrators.
I see. Well, you know, we spoke with you back in 2019 before Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. How's he handling this crisis? And do you think it could tarnish his legacy as a peacemaker?
Indeed, that's one of the things that has been discussed in recent times. Actually, even before this conflict, the country was plagued with recurrent ethnic violence and religious violence. So he and his administration have been struggling to contain the violence for quite some time. And now this is happening and there are airstrikes and civilians dying. So it's not going to be a good image for him.
The BBC's Kalkadan Yebatal speaking with us from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, about the violence breaking out in the northern part of the country there. Kalkadan, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
China is the latest major country to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden after last Tuesday's election. U.S.-Chinese relations have plunged to their lowest level in decades, with a tariff war over Beijing's technology ambitions and trade surplus, accusations of spying, tensions over human rights, the pandemic, and Hong Kong. Joe Biden has yet to speak to Chinese officials, but he did speak earlier this week with the leaders of Australia, Japan, and South Korea, and reassured them of America's commitment to the Asia-Pacific region. We've been tracking world reaction to the U.S. election, so let's check in now with NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing and NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul. We're going to start with you, Emily. What is China saying about Joe Biden's victory?
Well, it's been almost a week, and they finally acknowledged that the Electoral College has gone one way. What the Chinese Foreign Ministry said today was that they would extend their congratulations to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but they did not say, we congratulate them as the next president-elect and vice president-elect. They simply offered their congratulations. And then they couched that congratulations by saying that they congratulated these two people on the understanding that the final outcome of the election would follow American law and procedure, meaning we still don't know what the final outcome is, but we trust that the will of the American people will decide. So it was a very, very vague congratulations, and it did not mention that Joe Biden was the president-elect.
So it's hard to believe there's not a political motive behind that. What's the reluctance?
It's an abundance of caution. They know that President Trump has not yet conceded the election, and they are careful not to provoke him in the more than 2 months he still has in office. Trump has continued to sanction Chinese officials. He has put other sanctions on Americans investing in Chinese firms just this week. There's plenty he could do to contain China if he is provoked, and so Beijing is very careful not to be seen as supporting Joe Biden right out of the gate.
And by the way, what is Beijing expecting from a Biden presidency?
They're certainly expecting continued pressure from the U.S. on human rights issues, particularly when it comes to Hong Kong and Xinjiang, where there have been hundreds of thousands of people detained. But they're hoping they might be able to cooperate on things like trade, to bring the U.S. back into a regional trade alliance rather than ongoing trade war, which has started under President Trump, and to also cooperate on things like climate change, which Biden has made a cornerstone of his presidential campaign.
Anthony Kuhn, in Seoul, you wrote this week that President Biden reassured leaders of South Korea and Japan and Australia about America's commitment to them. What do they need reassuring about? And start with Japan.
Well, Trump has been saying since the 1980s that Japan is ripping the U.S. off, long before he started saying that about China. And what he said is that Japan runs a huge trade surplus with the U.S., that the past administrations in the U.S. have put us in unfair trade deals. And he sort of described Japan and South Korea as wealthy freeloaders who either should pay a lot more to have U.S. troops stationed in their countries, or they should go it alone and even go nuclear to do that. On China, Japan has been feeling a lot of pressure. Japan sees China as a challenge and a threat in the long term, but in the short term, they really don't want the U.S. poking Beijing in the eye and provoking a conflict that's not necessary.
What about in South Korea, where you're based? This, of course, is a huge alliance with the U.S. and a military alliance. What's a Biden presidency going to mean for South Korea and for President Moon Jae-in? Because the U.S. still has 28,000 troops there. President Trump has talked about pulling them out. Does Joe Biden have a position on that?
Well, yes. President Trump said he initially said he wanted a 500% increase in Seoul's contribution to the cost of stationing troops there. And if you just talk to veterans who fought with the U.S., you know, in the Korean War or something, to them this is just an unthinkable betrayal. It suggests that alliances are about money, not about values, and it turns U.S. troops into mercenaries. And Biden has made it clear that, as he said in a contribution to local media here, that he will not extort this U.S. ally.
So he doesn't necessarily want money for stationing U.S. troops there. Does he want the U.S. troops there at all, Biden?
Well, you know, there is a U.S. law that right now that says that troops cannot be withdrawn down below a certain level unless Congress deems it's in the U.S.'s national security interest. But, you know, the main thing is that he's giving the message that he gets it about allies. He's not going to treat them as lackeys or subordinates. It's, you know, he's going to treat he talks about the alliance in a much more respectful way.
North Korea poses such a threat on the peninsula, and it seemed that there was hope for a while in South Korea when President Trump focused so much attention on the North. He met with Kim Jong-un three times. Is that hope gone now?
Well, there was a kind of hope that, you know, although Trump's approach was erratic and risky, there was some hope that somehow this chemistry, which President Trump said he had with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, could somehow lead to a breakthrough, that they could have this sort of high-stakes one-on-one meeting and strike a deal. But that didn't work out, and now it's clear that Biden wants a multilateral approach and that he's not going to – you know, what he said is he wants to engage in principled diplomacy, implying that Trump's was not principled, and he wants to start with working level negotiations and not get into symmetry unless there's, you know, a clear indication of a deal, a clear strategy, and, you know, adequate preparations made in advance.
Emily Feng, we have to put all of this in the context of the coronavirus pandemic, which started in China. What effect is the virus having there right now?
Very, very little. There's been a couple of domestic cases, domestic transmissions this week. Authorities have quickly contact traced and put those people in medical observation. But because they're so good at being able to identify new cases as they come about and to lock down that area, then the rest of the country can still operate as normal. So people are traveling domestically, they're going to work, they're shopping, they're eating out in restaurants. Of course, this is all happening in this big, big bubble of China. No one who is a foreign citizen can enter or can enter China very easily right now. But things are almost pretty much back to normal.
Anthony Kuhn, Japan reported a record 1,600 new infections today. The government in South Korea, where you are, is going to start fining people who don't wear masks in public. South Korea got a lot of credit for the way it handled the pandemic in the beginning. How's it going now?
Well, certainly far from perfect. I mean, they've had to flatten two spikes, two infection curves. They've still got more infections than they'd like to. And they've, you know, achieved a lot of their success by accessing citizens' personal data in a way which would not be legally possible in the U.S. and many other Western countries. But the bottom line is their statistics, new cases, mortality, all these things still show them to be quite successful. They haven't had to have any real lockdowns. Their economy is doing just about any other in the developed world. And as in China, folks are able to go about their business pretty well, albeit with masks on all of the time. And as you mentioned, Japan's infections are still inching up, and the government has taken a lot of criticism for not acting more strongly. But still, compared to most Western countries, their figures don't look too bad.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, South Korea, Emily Feng in Beijing. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Committee to Protect Journalists is calling on the government of Zimbabwe to stop its, quote, relentless victimization of the respected journalist Hopewell Chinono and to drop all charges filed against him. Hopewell Chinono is an investigative journalist who has exposed government corruption that he linked to the family of the president. He was arrested this week for obstruction of justice and put in an overcrowded and filthy maximum security prison in Harare. The charge against him stemmed from a tweet he made alleging more corruption. One of his lawyers is Doug Coulthard. He spoke outside the court.
From our perspective, it's clear that he is being targeted for his journalism. That was made very clear in these charges, that they're about his journalism and his sources reporting on corruption. He has been fearlessly reporting on corruption issues, and that's really what this is about.
This is the second time Hopewell Chinono has been arrested and put in maximum security, even though he's never been convicted of a crime. The Committee to Protect Journalists says the government of Zimbabwe should stop its single-minded persecution of the journalist.
Schools in the city of Detroit are closing for in-person learning as coronavirus cases surge. In fact, many school districts are looking at local caseloads and wondering if they'll have to do the same. In Philadelphia, 10,000 of the city's youngest students were getting ready to go back to school on November 30th when Superintendent William Height reversed course this week and decided to keep the buildings closed. Superintendent Height joins us now. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And I know this must have been a hard decision to make, one that you spent plenty of time on, I'm sure. But why did you decide to delay the reopening of your schools?
Yeah, we made the decision using guidance and data from both the Philadelphia Department of Public Health and the Pennsylvania Department of Education and the Pennsylvania Department of Health. And we've always said from the start that we would make these decisions based on science. So there were, quite frankly, two data points that we use that became a part of our decision. And to be specific, those two metrics were the confirmed cases per 100,000 people over a seven-day period. The recommendation is that it should be at 100. Ours had reached 164.7 per 100,000. And the other metric was the positivity rate over a seven-day period. And for the week ending last week, November 5th, that rate was 9.1% and increasing very rapidly. And so we thought, instead of trying to bring young people back after the holiday, that we would just put that decision off until those two metrics begin to decline.
I see. Now, two-thirds of your parents had actually already opted to keep their kids at home this fall. But what do you know about the parents that were planning to send their kids back? I mean, these may have been families that can't afford childcare, that need to get back to work.
Yeah, and a hybrid model would have only brought young people back 2 days a week. And what we know about those individuals who were selecting, many of those individuals were instead the individuals who wanted their young people to come back in order to socialize with their peers, to be face-to-face with their teachers, and to gain some in-person experience, particularly for our youngest learners in pre-kindergarten and kindergarten.
Mm. I know the local teachers' union is likely thrilled with this decision because they, of course, the teachers were concerned about their own health in the classroom. But as you know, many other districts around the country have opened, and that they found that schools haven't actually been a major source of outbreaks in the community. Do you think there's a chance that you're being too conservative, especially with these younger kids?
There is always a chance that we're being too conservative. But in this case, as I indicated, we are guided by the science. And we are going with recommendations from both our local health department and the state health department. And just recently, a children's hospital here in Philadelphia suggested that all Philadelphia area schools go to a virtual program at least for the next several weeks, simply because of the case increases that we're experiencing here. And so while I think, yes, we understand that many schools have gone back and haven't seen the level of cases come through or increase, at a time we are experiencing higher case counts than we have since the epidemic started. And so we thought we would rely and default to safety of our families and safety of our staff members by just delaying that decision.
Many of the buildings in your district in the city are older. Ventilation is an issue. Is that something that you've been able to address while the students have been away?
It is, and we're going to continue to address those issues. And we have the average age of our buildings of 70 years old. And not only are there ventilation issues, there are environmental issues. And we've been able to get in and do a good bit of the environmental abatement, particularly with asbestos-containing materials, lead paint. We've done significant amounts of work around those two things, and we're testing every space to measure the fresh airflow. And so we're doing ventilation assessments in any space that will occupy students or teachers. We are making that information public by schools so that individuals have a clear picture of what the ventilation reports indicate.
Anyone with kids, as you can imagine, this is just a totally disruptive year. It's been awful for everybody trying to navigate this, for you included. I just wonder if you've been able to measure how far behind your kids have fallen academically, how far behind they've fallen socially over the past year now as they're facing this new disruption.
Yes, and so we have been measuring. We have done an initial assessment in kindergarten through 12th grade and looking at those results and determining what some of our young people will need, particularly in English language arts and math. But I'm more worried about the isolation, particularly that our younger children and in many cases our older children are experiencing. And we're hearing from many of our young people how much they miss their peers, they miss the socialization aspects and the communities that are developed when children are in school environments. And so I do worry with that, particularly for our youngest children.
You know, but it sounds like you think the risk of COVID is even greater. Superintendent of the School District of Philadelphia, William Height, thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.
Barack Obama releases his much-anticipated memoir, A Promised Land. We'll hear him talk about the book and his hopes for a Biden administration next time on Here and Now.